Welcome to the Songs of Note podcast, where we talk about the songs we love and the stories behind them. I'm your host, Ryan Gregg. Hey, this is Ryan. Thank you so much for joining me for the Songs of Note podcast, where we talk about all things music. Before we get started, I wanted to mention something real quick. If you haven't done it yet, there is a free bonus episode of the Songs of Note podcast that you can't find anywhere unless you do it through my website by entering in your email, and I'll send you a copy of the free episode. To do that, you just go to thesongsofnote.com/bonus. And when you enter that, I'm going to send you in return an email that's going to give you a link to an unreleased episode of the podcast. You're also going to get a playlist that you can click to on Apple Music or on Spotify of 27 of my favorite songs of all time. And that's what the episode is about, is I'm talking through the songs, and some of it goes into like personal stories and the song that I played when I got on the highway to leave college. I mean, so yeah, if that's of interest to you, go get it. If not, no problem. But when you enter your email and I send you that, that's going to put you on my newsletter. So if you want to make sure you don't miss anything that I'm sending out, whether it's music recommendations or stuff I'm liking, just I promise to only send things that I think you might find interesting. But again, www.thesongsofnote.com/bonus. A band that I love, that I really, really love, is Arcade Fire. Now, you may or may not know Arcade Fire. If you do, this is going to be about their album, Funeral, which was their debut album that was released in the early 2000s, came out in 2004. And so if you don't know the album, you should absolutely check it out. It's a fantastic album, you know, top to bottom. I've been wanting to do an episode on Arcade Fire, and I was like, man, who would I talk to about this band? And so where I landed was, you know what? What I remember was being a guy in my 20s who religiously followed Pitchfork. So if you've heard of Pitchfork, it's a website, and they would do these indie music reviews. And I guess it makes sense that I'm somebody that would love music reviews, because that's kind of what we do here, is talk about music. But growing up, I was always reading in college, always reading Rolling Stone reviews, and always wanted to read music reviews. And then once everything went online, Pitchfork really like led the way as far as what was cool. At least that's how I saw it. And what music was great to get into, because I always wanted to know what the new thing was. And so what I remember was, you know, I remember reading a review about Arcade Fire when they first came out. And so I went down this rabbit hole trying to find that review, and I found it. And the person who wrote the review was named David Cooper Moore, and he was kind enough to come back on the show. So this review, this review gave a 9.7 rating out of a 10. And so from the website that I saw, was like the musical Bible of the time, that is just unprecedented. And I just remember that having such a huge impact that I was like, oh, I need to take this seriously, because this is a for real band. And he was right. I mean, the album still stands up. It's incredible, and I love it. But that's kind of how we got to this episode. And it was like, okay, you know, he was kind enough, David was kind enough to say he would come on the show and talk about the review. And not, you know, I think it's interesting to hear about, you know, what was the scenario around Pitchfork at the time? What did he feel when he first was introduced to the music from the band? So we're going to talk about that. So David Cooper Moore is a teacher and media educator based in Philadelphia. Back in 2004, he was writing music reviews, but you can find him online at dcoopermoore, that's M-O-O-R-E .medium.com, or he's on Twitter at dcoopermoore. And just super nice guy, and appreciate him being willing to talk about the band. And I love Arcade Fire, and I love the album Funeral. So let's hop on over to a discussion with David Cooper Moore. Hey, this is Ryan. I have David Cooper Moore here. David, thank you so much for taking time to chat today.
Thanks for having me.
So, man, I really appreciate you being willing to come on and talk about the band, because it's cool to connect with you. And then here's what I would like to do. I want to tell you how I absorbed your review, and then I want to back into what happened and how all this happened. So for me, I was a huge, huge music fan, and you know, Pitchfork was the Bible of indie rock. When all this was going down in the early 2000s, I mean, I would check the site every day, and if an album got a review of a 9 or even probably like an 8, I mean, I would buy it without even listening to it. I was so in. And so it fascinated me to look back on this review when I was searching for some Arcade Fire stuff, and I was like, man, 9.7 is what you rated this album back at the time. And I just remember, as soon as I saw that, I was like, oh my gosh. So before I even heard a note, I was so enthralled as to what this could be. So my question for you to start things off, how did you first get in touch with Pitchfork and writing reviews? Like, what was your introduction to them before we even talk about the band?
Well, it sounds like it was pretty similar to your introduction. You know, I was, I guess when I was about 18 or 19, you know, I read Pitchfork every day. You know, I was kind of getting into music to try to be like hanging out with, I guess they weren't actually cool, but I thought they were cool. You know, the cool music kids, mm-hmm. and, you know, mm-hmm. maybe in my high school.
I do know.
Yeah. And so, you know, I had done this with movies like a couple of years before, where I just started renting. You know, when I get into things, I tend to get pretty obsessive. And so I would watch like, you know, 10 movies that I got from the, you know, from the VHS place, like every couple of days, and I'd return them and get 10 more. And so I started doing the same thing with music, probably around, you know, 2000. And for me, you know, rock critics were like my homework, right? Like I came home from school, and instead of doing my homework, I would just read what I could read. And what was there was All Music Guide was there, which was huge. And Pitchfork was huge if you wanted slightly more recent music. And so I just was reading it. I remember by 2003, they actually had like a compilation book. It was called the Thesaurus Musicarium or something. It was like a, you know, it was like an ancient text that they had printed out. They just had a whole bunch of the reviews from it, you know, the older reviews. Mm. And I bought that. I no longer own it, so I can't tell you exactly what's in it. So as I, you know, got a little bit older, I started getting more into connecting with people who liked music, and most people who liked music were on certain message boards, and they had blogs. And I was like, oh, I should start a blog. So my then girlfriend, who's now and still my wife, basically said, yeah, you talk to me about this stuff all the time. You should probably start a blog. I said, okay. So I started writing just random stuff, on this blog and, you know, posting to a couple of message boards, not very much. And I basically got into a comment war with Dominique Leone, who wrote there at the time, whose name I've never said out loud. So I may have just mispronounced it. And yeah, it was about dance punk and the chick, chick, chicks, you know, the three exclamation points.
Okay.
I don't know if they like settled on a way to pronounce that.
Chick, I don't know. Chicks
or shushushas or whatever they called themselves. And I liked their new album, and, you know, they didn't. And so we went back and forth. And basically, you know, at that time, if you got into a high enough profile message board back and forth, you know, the people at Pitchfork knew who you were. You know, they were reading all the same stuff. And so I think,
oh, that's great.
So, you know, they had like an open call for writers, and I, you know, I wrote something that, you know, I think I had at that point created like a fake music review website of my own at my college. Nice. So that I could get promos. Because even though, you know, this is before streaming, it was post Napster, pre streaming. People who weren't in college yet, especially, I mean, I was in college at the time, but it was actually somewhat difficult to get music if you weren't like hardcore into pirating music. It wasn't quite as effortless as streaming. So I wanted the promos, and I got many of them, and I sent some of my college stuff to Pitchfork, and Ryan Schreiber, who was the editor-in-chief there at the time, said, hey, yeah, I recognize you from this comment war that you got in. You should like send a couple of reviews in. And so what they did was, they said, if you write for us for like, what did they have to, you had to like write 4 reviews for free, and then you got the privilege of writing for them for free for 3 months, after which they might pay you. Awesome. That was where Pitchfork was at,
20 years ago.
Institutionally at the time.
Yeah.
My dad was thrilled, right? I wrote some terrible reviews that I do not remember very well, but they went up and they were fairly quiet. And then, you know, the way this all worked then, it was all like, you know, it was message boards and there was instant messenger chat. I didn't have a cell phone yet. So like, you know, I tell people like it's important to remember that 2004 in a lot of ways was more like 1994 than it was like 4 or 5 years after that, right? 2008.
That's true. That's true.
So, you know, like Ryan Schreiber was calling my dorm room like a couple times a week about some review that I was writing and saying, hey, can you do this one instead? We were chatting on Instant Messenger and this Arcade Fire album, I guess the promo had leaked or something. And, you know, one of my friends had gotten it to me and said, hey, I think you're really going to like this one. And he actually said that, I think he was making fun of me. He was like, this is so like wide-eyed and sincere. You're going to love this crap. And I did. So I was chatting with Ryan Schreiber on IM, which is not a phrase that you can really use anymore. And I said, hey, this is a long shot, but has anybody claimed this review yet? The album was supposed to release in about a week. And he said, yeah, I mean, I think I want to write about it, but I don't think I can do it. And I don't really, you're kind of new. So maybe write me. He basically said, write me like a couple of paragraphs on spec and send it to me and I'll see what I think. And I wrote him, you know, what would become the first couple of paragraphs. And he was like, yeah, just write that. And then we just had to haggle about the score and that was about it. And after that, I kind of lost my taste for all of this. I was, I was not great at meeting deadlines and writing reviews. So I stopped after a couple of months, but it was wild.
Man, that's crazy. Well, yeah. Then let's talk about the album itself. Like when you heard it, because I've been listening to it all week again, and I've just worn that album out, and it still sounds fresh to me now. Do you remember like your initial impressions? Because I know they had like an EP out before that just kind of hinted at where they were heading. Yeah. But this album just felt like a fully realized band and sound, and it kind of blew me away. I don't know, how did it hit you? Do you remember how you felt?
Yeah, you know, I remember because my friend had suggested I would like this in a way that was like, you know, this is me totally up your alley. Like, he had my number, you know. At first, I was listening to it, and I was like, oh, I don't know. And then, you know, I was listening to it more. And one thing that I did was I'd been listening to it on headphones from what I guess it must have been pirated or something from the promo. And I basically got the promo CD, and I had an old, like, Bose, you know, CD player, and I put it on, and I actually listened to it like for real, like out of speakers. And I like, it's like I heard it for the first time. And the main thing that I heard was, you know, just the very beginning of Neighborhood Number One, when he sings about, you know, we think of bedrooms, our parents' bedrooms, and the bedrooms of our friends. And it was like, it's a little on the nose, but like I had not thought about my parents' bedroom or my friends' bedrooms since I was probably 10. It had been like 10 years.
Yeah.
And, you know, the thing that I know now that I obviously wasn't ready to go into at the time was like, you know, my parents' bedroom had this very special place in my own memory because, you know, my mom was sick growing up and she died when I was 7. Oh. And so to have an album called Funeral that is like, hey, think about your parents' bedroom real quick.
Oh man.
And like your friends' bedrooms. And also think about death, and you know, and I'm like,
yeah.
Oh, I should do that, and you know, put me into a really, you know, like a spiritual place, which I think a lot of people had a similar experience with it. You know, I there was a lot of flack in the broader music press at the time. You know, I remember was it Robert Christgau wrote a review of Funeral. And he was like, you know, they lost a grandparent or whoever, you know, like whoever died. And I'm like, yeah, okay, that was overblown. And it came from like their PR stuff. But there was something about it that on that level. Not that I could write about that at that time, because I was just experiencing it pretty much for the first time on a bit of a journey, you know, outside of music for that.
But, yeah.
More like therapy than anything else. But that was the thing. It was the very first song. You know, his voice was like, I remember hearing him and thinking like, this is, you know, like my you know, my cool music friends, right, who I always wanted to impress, always wanted me to listen to Bright Eyes.
Mm-hmm.
They always tried to get me to letting off the happiness, I think it was, or whatever it's called.
Mm-hmm.
And I hated it so much, and I would listen
so
to it.
So did I.
Like, what is this? This
right.
is awful. Why do people connect with this so much? Like, and he sounded a little bit like that at first. Mm-hmm. I think that kind of is more apparent on the first song than it is elsewhere.
Yeah.
It certainly wasn't like the main mode of how they sang moving forward. So it's like that, you know, there was a friction to it where I was like, my brain is telling me that I really shouldn't like this. And then, you know, the rest of you is just like, sorry, this is it. This is you. So that was my experience with it.
Man, thank you for sharing. And gosh, yeah, sure. It's interesting the way that stuff will hit us personally, different yeah. from than the creators of it even expected. Gosh, and yeah, so that's interesting. It's such a personal connection there. But it, you know, even for the songs having a melancholy aspect, mm-hmm. a mournful aspect in a lot of ways, it's also like full of, it feels full of hope. And I don't know that that's even based on the words as much as the feeling I get from the music. Like Wake Up yeah. was one that, yeah. I mean, my wife and I walked into our wedding reception to that song because it came out like around the time, and it was like, this is the biggest, most like yeah. awesome feeling I've felt from anything current in so long. And it makes me feel good. I can't tell you a single like thing that comes to mind when I think of what's that song about. I just know it makes me feel great.
I think it's about waking up.
Yeah. Well, there you go. But it's interesting though, the stuff that we pull from music, whether it's direct or indirect, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, I think U2 felt the same way about it because they opened their tour. It was weird. Like, they opened their tour playing another band's song to get everybody pumped up. Like, okay.
I remember that. Yeah.
The Super Bowl a couple of years after that.
That's right.
Yeah, that was like the anthem. You know, that song in particular was clearly, I mean, it was big for them too. I remember reading after that. I read, you know, it's so funny. Like, I wrote the review before I knew literally anything about them.
Hmm.
I had this, like, PR sheet that compared them to animals. I probably still have it somewhere, like in my parents' house, you know, my parents' bedroom, maybe. You know, like some old yellowed PR one sheet where it's like, out of the cold Montreal something, the tigers and the leopards are dancing together. I'm like, what the hell are they talking about? And there was one article about them that really went into the backstory in Exclaim, the Canadian magazine. Mm-hmm. But I didn't see it until after I'd already filed the first draft of the review. And it's one of those things where you're reading it and you're like, oh no, I already, it's too late. I learned all this stuff and I've already written this. I didn't know anything about them, but apparently Wake Up was a huge thing where in their live show in Canada, they would always open with that song. And it was part of how they kind of got the audience on their side. You know, there was this,
oh yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it, you
collective.
Know, yeah. Yeah. Pitchfork was very American centric. I mean, maybe it still is, but, yeah, I remember in 2003, Ryan Schreiber wrote a review of Broken Social Scene, and the whole premise of the review was that he basically found it in a box and it was random. He's like, I found this old CD. Like, what is this? And of course, like, if you ask people from Canada, they're like, Broken Social Scene was huge.
Huge.
Like, you know, and Arcade Fire was with them, you know, and
yeah.
you know, connected to the other folks, you know. But like, that just was not clear at the time, like, to me anyway. I mean, people that were a little bit more in the know, like, left their rooms.
That's funny.
Go to shows and stuff.
Well, you brought up one of the songs, the neighborhood yeah. number one, and you know, they have four of the 10 songs include the word neighborhood.
Yeah.
So for people who don't know the album, we have neighborhood number one, and in parentheses, they'll have the title Tunnels, neighborhood number yeah. two, Lake at neighborhood number three, Power Out, neighborhood number four, Kettles. What do you think is the significance of neighborhood? And then two, what it was specifically about neighborhood number one that really struck you? I know you said that was the one that you really connected with.
Yeah.
I think
it was one of those things where sometimes somebody can say something to you directly, like really directly. And it's so on the nose that you just don't hear it, right? You know, I mean, it's like with a movie where, you know, it, like the person says to the other person, I've always been in love with you, and you just roll your eyes because it's like a cliche. Mm-hmm. And then there's times when you can do that and it works, and it's almost more powerful because it shouldn't have worked. Hmm. So for me, like they, you know, the neighborhoods and the bedrooms and, you know, like a weird magical snow day. I mean, they really were drawing this very specific picture of my own, like childhood, you know, mm-hmm. being relatively like comfortably suburban,
yep.
and hanging out with my friends and feeling like you go from bedroom to bedroom. I mean, not everybody experiences their childhood this way, but I think many people who experience their childhood this way are also the kind of people that were religiously reading Pitchfork.
Okay. That's true. I mean, that's true for me. Yeah, I'm with you.
I'm like, yeah, I mean, you know, that's my childhood. I think it's like today, the stuff that tries to talk to me directly, I tend to be very skeptical of. And it was probably true then too, but I don't know. It worked. And because it was so obvious, it actually worked more effectively than it would have been. So like with neighborhoods, I mean, yeah, it's your neighborhood, right? I mean, that is the unit of geography that, especially as a kid, that you are really familiar with, right? Like what is your neighborhood? Who's in your neighborhood? Who are your neighbors, right? And I think you kind of lose that a little bit coming out of childhood until maybe adulthood when you have to kind of
when you're back,
and then you're like, yeah, it takes
I'm back in a neighborhood.
Yeah, I got a neighborhood again. I got to care about this guy.
That's true.
In my yard or whatever.
Well, it's interesting. You know, you say that, and it makes me think of like community, and it mm-hmm. makes me think of. I mean, there's all kinds of things that lends itself to, and even the band itself being so many people feels like a tribe. In something that. You brought up at the beginning of your review was even, you know, to associate them with was even Talking Heads. You started the review mentioning a David Byrne quote. And immediately I'm like, oh, these guys are on par with Talking Heads. Like how naive am I at the time to like I'm just like, yes. I'm just drinking it. But it's like, oh, they're on par with Talking Heads. But it's because I think the music was so good that I think I completely agreed. But ever since reading that review, I've always equated them with Talking Heads. Now it's probably because they covered This Must Be the Place, and I associate them in that way as well. But were you the one that made the initial connection to Talking Heads, or had somebody else mentioned that, or do you remember?
I don't know. I there was one review that I remember reading before I wrote mine, and that was the one I think. Which was the one at maybe it came out before mine published, but I'd already written it. It's one at Stylus Magazine, which isn't around anymore. But I actually wrote for after I wrote for Pitchfork, and I reread that recently just to see if like I had gotten anything from it. And the very first line, it's like comparing the band to like a Detroit Tigers pitcher. And I was like, this must not be where I got any of this. So I don't know. I mean, I remember really grappling with like. You know, because there was a lot of talk about how this was going to be a highly reviewed album, you know, and at the time, Pitchfork was kind of, they were both very aware and very dense about the actual influence they had. Like, Pitchfork thought they had a lot of influence, but I don't think they understood how many people they were actually reaching and how. So, like, they thought they had a lot of influence in a much smaller place than what they ultimately did, at least with the Arcade Fire. I mean, you know, you can go back 6 months and like there's a 9.6 review of Blueberry Boat by the Fiery Furnaces, which I'm sure you purchased at some point.
Probably did.
I mean, one of the reasons I wanted it to be, I wanted to give the album a 10 when I reviewed it. I said, you can give it a 9.7 because it doesn't get to be worse than Blueberry Boat.
That's funny.
And it can't be better than Moon in Antarctica, which was 9.8.
Nice. Well, it's funny though, because when you're looking at the review and looking at the all the other albums that were coming out, like they might rate somebody incredibly high, you know, in the future. And I would get it, and my mind would say, oh, they said this was good, but I'm listening, going, I don't know. So like, I think that like there was a point where I stopped drinking the Kool-Aid, and it was like, oh, I don't know. But But they did like introduce me to like bands like was it Clap Your Hands Say Yeah, was a great one.
Next big one. Yeah.
I think was it Chad Van Gallen? There was another. I mean, I went and bought all these. Living in Dallas, there's a good record store, so they actually had these in stock, and it made the buying experience really fun to be able to go and actually find these rare. They seem like rare records, you know, in stores that nobody knew of, and you just felt like you were on such the front line of music by at least I did.
Yeah,
you know, well, being into this stuff.
Yeah, I'd go further back than that. You know, I bought albums by like Walt Mink and 12 Rods, who are bands that I guess maybe it's a Chicago thing. I don't know. Like these are bands that only Pitchfork ever wrote about that I'm aware of, that I bought all of, and I would listen to them. Like, what is happening? Like, why did I buy this? Like, I would spend a lot of money on some of this stuff for me anyway. I mean, like,
me too.
Given I was working as like a receptionist, I was like, man, I spent a lot of money for this, you know, 12 Rods EP or whatever it was.
That's funny.
Anyway, yeah, I think, I don't know. It was definitely a time and place. I think there needed to be a slight feeling of scarcity to have it work the way that it did. And I think that scarcity was pretty much gone a couple of years later. And a lot was changing too. I mean, you got to the point where, you know, obviously by 2010, Arcade Fire won the Grammy for best album, right?
Right.
But also like by 2008, 2009 into 2010, indie bands were getting number one records,
right,
like on the charts, because not because they were selling a ton. I mean, they were selling pretty well. It was because everybody else was selling way less.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's like there weren't these blockbuster albums anymore.
Right.
And so, you know, I think Funeral was the beginning of that phase where indie became more of a description of like a sound that could compete for like a number one slot on the album's chart, say. And I don't think that's changed that much. I mean, if anything, it's gotten worse because there's fewer people selling millions of records and more people selling, you know, a couple, maybe 100,000 if they're lucky.
I mean, that's right on. Yeah. Well, something else you brought up was Win Butler's voice.
Yeah.
And it's funny because his voice hit me a little different than I think it hit you. I think this is like, I'm such a vocals guy and I'm going to date myself, but gosh, I love Pearl Jam, Eddie Vedder's vocals. I love Kurt Cobain's vocals. I mean, I was in junior high when those things came out, and I obviously you latch onto the things you latch onto when you're younger. So I loved like a strong vocalist, and ever since I first heard this band, I always thought, you know what, I love the band sound. I don't think I would go buy a Win Butler solo record, but I love that when I think of the band, I think of it as a collective unit. But I don't really think of any other bands in that way. Like his voice almost seemed like the least important part. It almost seemed like the sound was so good and the songs were so good that his voice was an afterthought. And I don't know that I can't think of other bands that I group like that. Like Radiohead's not like that. I mean, they are certainly a band sound, but I would still listen to Tom York solo stuff. So I don't know. What do you think?
I would put the Pixies in that category.
Okay.
Somewhat in
that. I can see that.
I don't think that there's anything specifically unique about Frank Black's voice. And when you listen to his solo stuff, what you hear is like, oh yeah, I can hear like half to one fourth of the Pixies like really doing his thing. And
And,
you know, it's good, but it's much less full sounding than when you have everybody kind of working together. Yeah. I mean, I think that that was something that happened around the suburbs, I think. And it was not in effect on Funeral at all, where, you know, Win Butler kind of became more of a front man.
After Funeral,
but during Funeral, you know, when I saw them, like right during the whole thing in November of 2004. And it was actually a very funny story because I was supposed to interview them for my college paper.
Oh, wow.
And I was so nervous. It was, you know, it was at a little, they booked this venue. I mean, this happened with a lot of their venues where they booked a venue that was way too small for how many people wanted to go.
Okay.
And so I had to say I was doing an interview to get in because they were sold out within like 5 seconds or something.
Oh, wow.
And so I got a press pass to this college show. And, but you know, when they performed at that time, it was all of them were like in a straight line. And at any given moment, any one person could kind of be the focal point in the group. And, you know, I remember watching, I never saw them after that. I guess you like met them after the show too, because they were, you know, it was a small place.
You did get to meet them?
Yeah, I did. Yeah,
oh, that's cool.
I met him. It was cool. Like I met him. They came to like a college party, you know, and they.
That's awesome.
They came in like stomping, like in single file.
That's great.
Singing together, which, you know, the hipsters in the crowd rolled their eyes and the indie kids geeked out about it, you know.
I love it.
Then, you know, nicest people. I mean, it's not like I've met anybody.
Right.
They were incredibly nice.
Well, that's great. Nice,
awkward conversation. All I remember was talking about Sire Records and not really knowing exactly what they were talking about because I was too nervous to listen. Anyway, so all in like kind of single file. They were all kind of like, you know, they were like flat like across the stage. And by the Madison Square Garden thing they did for the suburbs, like they really looked a little bit more like a traditional rock outfit where singers in the front and the band's kind of in the back. They had that vibe of just like everybody's kind of singing together so that you could kind of hear it that way even when the vocals were really prominent.
Yeah.
And of course, you got, you know, Regine Chassan's vocals, which are amazing.
Yeah.
I mean, she, like, now I actually think she has the better songs on the album.
Oh, interesting. Yeah.
Like, as I've gotten older, I've liked her stuff more than his stuff, I think.
Interesting. I'd say I like her songs a lot more now than I did back then as well, though. They're complex. And, but when they first came out, I was like, I want to hear the guy singing. and now it really brings a nice contrast to have both of them.
Yeah.
Well, do you like their other, I mean, they've had a number of albums now, but like, where do you land as far as like, do you enjoy listening to Arcade Fire still?
Oh, I've gone on the journey with them. You know, this was like a weird time in my own life. I was going through a lot of personal stuff, if it wasn't clear from my, my very effusive and emotional review that I wrote. And I always associate this album with such intense feelings of that time that it's actually very difficult for me to listen to now without kind of going back there.
Yeah.
It's a place I try not to go back to too much.
Gotcha.
So I actually like I listen to their newer records more than their older ones. And I honestly, like, at this point, I mean, I remember when, what was it, Everything Now?
Yeah.
I think there was a song, it was the album too, right?
That's
the name of it. Okay. And that came out, I listened to it, and I thought it was, first of all, I thought it was kind of funny, which I think they were going for.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought it was good and interesting. And it got just totally destroyed.
Destroyed on the reviews. Yeah.
But I found it very charming. So I was like, oh, this is really nice. Like, because I always thought that they should do like a children's album, like what They Might Be Giants did.
They'd be great at that.
I was like, oh, that would be really good sound for
them. Totally.
But I don't know.
Interesting.
So I've kept up with them. I remember being disappointed in Neon Bible, but now I actually really love Neon Bible a lot.
Yeah.
I remember being really like psyched about The Suburbs right when it came out and then cooling on a little bit and then getting back. I never got into Reflector. It was the one album I never found a way in. There was a couple of songs off of it that I thought were pretty good, but
yeah.
I don't know. That was very much not my thing at that time.
it felt to me like they kept getting further away from the thing that I fell in love with, but they still on every album they put out at least one or two that I'm like, oh, that's the band that I still love.
I don't think you could replicate what happened on Funeral. I mean, it's such a weird, perfect kind of lightning in a bottle moment for them. I mean, it was, you know, like it sounds both amateurish and huge. Like, it sounds like there's, like, you know, it sounds like they're trying to, like, fill a stadium with instruments that are made for, like, a small club. And it's like working somehow. And you're like, how is this working, right? Like, how did you take these, like, toy instruments or whatever and put them together and create a sound that was so big that you can actually fill, like, a stadium with it? Like, I don't know how you do that again because, you know... Weirdly, the band that I think of the most around that is Sleigh Bells, right? Who similarly start with this very scrappy sound where they're like, I'm going to try to take this, like, you know, sticks and twine way of making the music, and I'm going to fill a stadium with it. And they really did it. And then they had to change because they couldn't keep doing it. And I love where that band went with their
sound. Oh, me too.
I think Arcade Fire did something similar. They're like, look, we can't all yell together. We can't all go, whoa, whoa, whoa together.
Forever. Right.
Forever. And so I kind of appreciate that it's like its own kind of special thing in its own time.
You know, it makes me, I've talked about this quote before, but there's a quote from Neil Young talking about when he was giving advice to Pearl Jam. I'm going to bring up Pearl Jam twice in the Arcade Fire podcast. That's cool. Not cool, but I'm going
to
do it.
No, it's 2021. You're allowed to do these things now. We're past rock and optimism.
It's all fine. That's all fine. That's right.
Everything is talking.
It's all okay.
Talking now.
He gave them the advice that just do what you want to do. Don't do the stadium tours. Do the small tour. Only do the sound that you want to do. And when you look at Neil Young's career, he did like 50 sounding albums, but in the 1980s, like he did all these oddball things, but he did what he had to do for his own sanity and for his own career. And he kept going and he kept doing it. Yeah. And so I'd say for like Arcade Fire.
And now he won't stop releasing any of it.
And now he won't stop. And man, I love some Neil Young. I mean, they're bringing out albums that he's never even released from somebody so long ago. I could go off on Neil Young. I love
it. It's crazy. Yeah.
But the Arcade Fire thing, I you know, when Everything Now came out, which was their most recent one, it felt like their most commercial, but also like, if that's what you want to do, if that's the thing that, if you actually feel passionate about those songs and you love it, then they should, you know, more power to them. If they started going that way for money and popularity, then I start questioning the motives of the music, but I don't know. I just know I liked some of those songs and, you know, people hated on it, but shoot, they're a great band and I can't fault them for what they've done.
Yeah. I heard some people compare Everything Now to, what was the U2? U2 did a similar thing. Was that Zooropa or something?
That was the oddball one for them.
I appreciated it. I mean, I guess it was because I'd had enough distance and I didn't have any expectations anymore for what kind of music it was going to be. I appreciated the experimentation on it and the attempts at humor. I mean, you know, like that was the other thing was that I think they lost some of the humor as they went along. And I don't regret it, but I do kind of wish that I could have captured a lot more like the joy that I was getting from the album, because I think that, you know, but what I wrote ended up coming across as very like heavy, very, very tragedy focused, which is where my head was at. But like, you know, the second song, they're like singing about vampires who got to collect their tears in a cup, and then the cops show up and it's disco lights and they're all dancing at the end, you know. I'm like, that's kind of funny, actually.
That's a good point. The quirkiness can add to the love for something. That's for sure.
Yeah.
That's awesome. Well, man, David, I really appreciate you coming on to talk about this album. And it's a random topic, but you know, I really appreciate you being willing to talk about a review you wrote a long time ago that I think helped catapult this band to the success they went on to have. I think that your review had a big part of that, for explaining to other people, hey, this is something really good and you should take it seriously and check it out. And I did. And I know so many other people did too. So I think it's cool that you played a part in that. And I always appreciate people recommending good music, which is what I'd say a good review does. So thanks for being willing to come on the show and talk about the album today.
Yeah, thanks so much.
Thank you for listening to the Songs of Note podcast. Be sure and subscribe so you don't miss an episode. See you next time.